The day of recording is the 14th of April. So I would say that over the past 2 days, markets have started to discount that the ceasefire in the Middle East will last possibly longer than the 2 weeks that are on schedule. And in fact, the market has started to price a possible peace in the Middle East. And I think that this pricing of a peace or even the ceasefire holding for that long is a bit too optimistic, unfortunately. I would think that if we see an escalation of the war and an extension of the war to other countries, as we have already seen in the Middle East, but I think that we could see a much more intense extension of the conflict to new countries. I wouldn't rule out that by the end of this year or early 2027, we cross 150. And I mean, the $200 per barrel is also on the horizon because, as I just said, I don't think that this conflict ends anytime soon. And the longer it lasts, in fact, the more damages will be done to all this oil and gas asset in the Middle East. Any commodities which are derived from oil or from the gas, from the LNG, which was sourced out of the Middle East. So fertilizers are one of them. I mean, around 30% of the global fertilizer supply was coming out of the Middle East. This is completely disrupted. We are just on time for the planting season in the northern hemisphere, meaning that farmers are going to lack fertilizer at this time of planting, meaning that the yields of future crops will be badly impacted.
Good day, everybody. It's me, just Steve Yang, here with Natural Resource Stocks, mining for stories that matter. Good to have you guys. I'm here with Laurent Lequeux, and he's with the Macro Butler. And Laurent, how are you?
A good day, Steve. It's very nice to be back on your show. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, my friend. Laurent, before we get into specifics, what is something in markets or energy right now that you think people are really missing?
Well, the day of recording is the 14th of April. So I would say that over the past 2 days, markets have started to discount that the ceasefire in the Middle East will last possibly longer than the 2 weeks that are on schedule. And in fact, the market has started to price a possible peace in the Middle East. And I think that this pricing of a peace or even the ceasefire holding for that long is a bit too optimistic, unfortunately. And I think that even if, let's say, a peace would materialize tomorrow, and we would be back in a situation we were on February 27, meaning before the start of this epic furry operation, it's likely that to go back to a normal supply of oil and other commodities coming out of the Middle East, it will take even months or possibly quarters. So I think that the markets are much more too optimistic in the way that this conflict will end.
So even if everything were to quote unquote go back to normal and the supply chain start moving, because there's been such a gap, you're not looking at just a month gap, you're looking more like possibly a quarter or even longer. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, I think that there are many issues to solve. First, there are a misallocation of boats of all kinds from the Middle East to Asia to America and Europe. So this will take time to move back the boats in the right place at the right port. Second, we all know that some oil and gas facilities have been hit in these conflicts. To repair these facilities, it will take at least months, if not quarters. And other facilities like aluminium plant in the Middle East or fertilizer plant in the Middle East have also been hit by the conflict. And I think that here as well, it should take at least months, not maybe even quarters, to be repaired and to go back to normal. And as I just said, this suppose that we go back to a pre-February 28 situation, which is unlikely given the state of the conflict and the disagreement that are still pending between both sides.
So when you say that it's unlikely, what are the reasons you believe that they're unlikely? Is it because something hasn't been resolved? Is it because the actions that either Washington, Iran is taking? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, and I've written this many times on my Substack and on my Telegram channel, this is a religious war. This is a kind of a holy war between two theocracies. So this is not the kind of war that is easily settled around the table. From the start, Israel and the US mentioned that they were looking for regime change. I mean, this has not really been achieved so far, even that the regime in Tehran has been decapitated. In fact, there has been no regime change. And in Iran, this war is a war for survival, is a war for survival for the regime. And also, in fact, for Israel, it's a war for survival because there's a pending election for Benjamin Netanyahu before October. So he would have also to show his voters that this epic ferry operation and the consequences that the Israeli people have suffered over the past 6 weeks has not been done for nothing. So I think that we are very far from reaching an agreement between the two sides. And I think, in fact, this ceasefire is just a time to reload the weapons from both sides and to wait for the season two of Epic Fury. We all know that the US have also put some 50,000 GIs around Iran. So it should be just a matter of time that season two of this Epic Fury operation come and translate on boot as a boot on the ground.
So, ceasefire to reload. Stop firing so we can bring out bigger weapons.
Well,
so,
I'm
go
not
ahead.
a military expert, but everyone knows that both sides needs to rebuild their storage of weapons. I mean, the US need to bring more missiles and more weapons from other theater of operation like Asia. And on the other side, Iran behind the curtain receive some help from Russia and China. And so they also need sometimes to rebuild their stockpile of drones and missiles.
So, I hear so many different narratives, first of all. Love to get your input on what's driving this war. You mentioned holy war, and I don't know if Israel and US is exactly on the same page when it comes to holy war. So if you could expound on that, what's driving the US into this war? Is it a holy war for the US as well, or is something else going on?
Well, I think for the US, this war is also a war against China indirectly. I mean, if we take a step back, in January, the US took out the Venezuelan president. Venezuela was one of the major oil suppliers of China. Last year, during the 12-day war, the US and Israel tried to take out the regime in Iran. Iran is also one of the major oil suppliers to China. And today, this war is in fact another war against China and try to stop China to expand its economic development by cutting China from one of its major oil suppliers. I would say that this is probably one of the reasons that President Trump agreed to follow Prime Minister Netanyahu in this war. I would think that from the side of Israel, I mean, it's no secret for nobody that Prime Minister Netanyahu over the past 20 years have mentioned that Iran was an existential threat to Israel. He always mentioned every month that Iran would be 2 weeks away to have a nuclear weapon. I mean, this has been the case for 20 years. So they are probably still 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon today, according to Prime Minister Netanyahu. But I would think that for Prime Minister Netanyahu, as I just said, he has become kind of a lame duck, a prime minister inside Israel. He has a trial on his back. And like all good prime minister or president, using a foreign bogeyman is a way to rally the people and the citizen around its own personal flag. So I would think that once again, like it has been the case in Europe with Ukraine, Israel is just using the Iranian boogeyman to try to divert the attention of the Israeli population from the real people, from the real problem of the population. Like it is the same in the US. At the end of the day, remember that President Trump was elected based on a peace mandate. But after 16 months in the Oval Office, I mean, he started three wars. And his economic.
Are we talking about the Nobel Prize? Nobel Prize winner here.
Well, he was supposed to candidate himself for the Nobel Peace Prize, but over the past few 6 weeks, he didn't talk about this anymore. So maybe it will be for next year. I'm not sure. But I would say that because his economic achievement over the past 16 months are not very conclusive, it's a way to rally the American people around his flag ahead of the midterm election. I'm not sure that he will be successful on this, but I would think that he needs also, like from Prime Minister Netanyahu, a conclusive end of this war. And this means that this war cannot end around a peace, a table and a negotiation of peace. And as I just said, for Iran, I mean, it's an existential threat for the regime. So at the end of the day, the Iranian regime has nothing to lose in this war. So there's no reason from any side to move ahead with a peace agreement. I personally think that the negotiation in Pakistan over the last weekend was kind of a sideshow to distract both investors and citizens from the fact that the restart of the war is almost inevitable.
So I want to take a little bit of a dive into oil a little bit. Zoom in on oil. Where do you think it goes from here? Are we seeing a new floor? Are we seeing what's the upside? What's the downside scenario of where, you know, things go if things escalate?
Well, I think that the downside scenario would be the scenario that a peace agreement is reached in the Middle East. As I said, I would not give more than 5 to 10% probability to this. I think that it is notorious that the U.S. Treasury has been intervening in the oil market by selling oil futures to try to cap the oil price. Governments around the world have used a strategic petroleum reserve also to try to cap the oil price. But all these measures are just temporary measures which will not replace the oil coming out from the Middle East. So I would think that even as of today, we are trading below $100 per barrel WTI. I would think that over the next few days or weeks, when the conflict restart, we reach a new level, which is around 120. And this 120 level would probably be the new floor going into the second half of the year and going into 2027. I would think that if we see an escalation of the war and an extension of the war to other countries, as we have already seen in the Middle East, but I think that we could see a much more intense extension of the conflict to new countries. I wouldn't rule out that by the end of this year or early 2027, we cross 150. And I mean, the $200 per barrel is also on the horizon, because as I just said, I don't think that this conflict ends anytime soon. And the longer it lasts, in fact, the more damages will be done to all this oil and gas asset in the Middle East. And on top of this, we are likely to see also a reacceleration of the war between Ukraine and Russia, now that the Hungarian government has been replaced over the past weekend. And so I would think that we will see not only disruption from the Middle East, but also probably from Russia, meaning that I wouldn't rule out $150, $180 per barrel by the end of the year and $200 per barrel by next year.
So when people think about supply chains, you know, we focus on oil. Those are some crazy numbers. We look at major metals. I spoke to somebody and he said that what we're not paying attention to is fertilizer, the amount of fertilizer that's going to affect, or is there anything that you're looking at right now that you're going, man, people are really overlooking? It's not just oil. There are other things that we need to think about.
I mean, there are many commodities which are derived from oil or from the gas, from the LNG, which was sourced out of the Middle East. So fertilizers are one of them. I mean, around 30% of the global fertilizer supply was coming out of the Middle East. This is completely disrupted. We are just on time for the planting season in the Northern Hemisphere, meaning that farmers are going to lack fertilizer at this time of planting, meaning that the yields of future crops will be badly impacted. And we have already seen this, in fact. I mean, this is already a reality here in Asia, where there's clearly shortages of fertilizer in countries like Thailand and India. So I would think that fertilizer is a very important sector that is not really looked at by investors, because it will impact food inflation over the next 6 to 9 months. In fact, I also wrote a few weeks ago an article about helium. Helium is also derived from natural gas, and Qatar was the major supplier of helium. Helium is required, among other, in the supply chain of semiconductor. So you will probably see also impact on this. In fact, Taiwan announced a few days ago that they will replace helium imports from Qatar by trying to import some helium out of the U.S. But there's clearly not enough helium in the U.S. for everyone. So I would think that there will be impact on this. In fact, yesterday, China just announced that it will probably put an export ban on sulfuric acid, which is also a derivative of oil and gas, and which is mostly used in the mining industry. So you are likely to see impacts also in the mining industry, meaning that that would probably push even much higher the prices of metals, because some miners will have difficulty to get this sulfuric acid on time and the right price for their mining operation. So I think that what a lot of people misunderstood is that this crisis is only starting. In fact, it's not even starting. We are going to see the consequences of this crisis in the real economy peaking in the next 6 to 9 months. And this is still assuming that it's not getting worse in the near future. Would there be further disruption from the Middle East? And we are not even talking about a potential issue around the Red Sea. We will probably see another wave of disruption coming in many markets. So I would think that investors should look for a stagflationary environment globally, at least for the next 12 to 24 months.
Stagflationary for the next 12, 24 months. You mentioned not even thinking about the Red Sea. Now, what's the likely, you talked about this is an indirect war on the U.S. against China. Could you expound on that a little bit? And if you can also talk about the Red Sea a bit.
Well, I'm just going to talk about the Red Sea first. I mean, we all know that the Red Sea is under the threat of the Houthis. The Houthis are kind of working in collaboration with the Iranian regime. So I would think that will there be, I would say, increased tension around the Strait of Hormuz? We could easily see the Houthis threatening again ships in the Red Sea. I mean, I just read this morning, in fact, that the George Bush aircraft carrier is not going to take the risk to go through the Red Sea to join the other Navy vessel of the US. Is going to make the big round around the South Africa. So it clearly shows that even the US Navy doesn't dare to risk one of its aircraft carriers in the Red Sea as of today. Talking about the war between China and the US, as I just said, I mean, the US have been trying to restrict oil supply to China. In fact, it has been the case since Donald Trump is back in the Oval Office. And I think that China is not, I mean, is aware of this. So we all know that after the 12-day war last year, first China increased its oil storage. Everyone was wondering why China is buying so much oil while the economy was slowing. But of course, it's because China was already expecting a second war in the Middle East. Then they concluded the railway between Iran and China, which means that, in fact, Iran is still able to export part of its oil via this railway. And third, in fact, after the 12-day war last year, China signed a big agreement with Russia to build a major pipeline from Siberia to China. So this is also part of China trying to bypass the maritime route and also increase the relationship between Russia and China. And I would say that this epic ferry operation will continue to tighten, to make China and Russia closer. I mean, the relationship between Russia and China started to be even closer after the start of the Ukraine war. And now that China is once again cut off some energy supply from Venezuela, from Iran, we can expect that the trade relationship between Russia and China will increase. This also means that, and I think that last time we discussed, I discussed that if you combine the supply of commodities from Russia with the state-of-the-art manufacturing capabilities of China, this creates a bloc which is unbeatable. And I think that this will be probably the start of the decline of the Western civilization and, at the end of the day, the end of the U.S. empire.
So a lot to unpack there. First of all, you We're talking about China. I do want to go back to the China. Or if you can go to the blockade, can you tell me about the blockade, what that's about, and is it an active slowing down of oil transport to China? I mean, is this an act of war? Where do things go?
Well, I think that it's well known that China and Iran have a close trade relationship. And as I said, I mean, the decision of President Trump to enforce a blockade of the blockade, I would say, is a way to stop any ships or coming out of Iran to reach China. I mean, it's not only China, because in fact, over the past 6 weeks, Iran sent oil tankers to India, to Pakistan, and even to Thailand. So it's not only China which is targeted, but it's mostly Asia. And since China is the major customer of Iran for its oil, I would think that this is a way to interfere in the trade relationship between China and Iran. And I think that the Chinese prime minister and the Chinese foreign minister have made clear that it's not the American business to interfere in the trade relationship between Iran and China. So I think that this could evolve into an act of war. I'm not really sure that the Chinese Navy wants to directly take a fight with the American Navy in the Indian Ocean. But on the other hand, I would think, and I think that I mentioned this also the last time that we were together, I think that this would probably trigger China to act around Taiwan, because if there is another strait that nobody is talking about today, is the Strait of Taiwan. And we all know that the U.S. Navy has relocated most of its force into the Middle East. And so it has opened the door for the Chinese Navy to proceed with a blockade of the Strait of Taiwan, which I think would be a way for China to tell the U.S., if you stop me to get oil from the Middle East, I will stop you to get semiconductor from Taiwan.
So the threat of semiconductors is a, my understanding, it's a pretty real one. And it's got the best semiconductors in Taiwan, is my understanding. Now, I also know that China is no secret that China has been eyeing Taiwan. And I guess what I've heard is that they're using what's happening now as a way to make good, not good graces as much as, you know, open conversation and maybe improve relationships with Taiwan. Is that going on right now? Is, where is Taiwan in all this? Like, if you were to ask people in Taiwan, what's their sentiment of what the U.S. is doing? Because my understanding also is that the U.S. isn't making many friends right now.
Well, I don't really know the secret of Taiwan, but what I know is that the leader of the opposition to the Taiwanese government was in Beijing last week, and she went there to meet Xi Jinping, and she came to Beijing with a message of peace. So there's clearly also a way that she wants to present herself as an alternative, as a regime change alternative in Taiwan. And since we always talk about regime change, and it seems that only the US can impose its regime changes to the rest of the world, I wouldn't be surprised that for once, China would impose its regime change in Taiwan, which at the end of the day can be done by strangling economically Taiwan. And as I just said, this means that it's not really meaning that the Chinese army will invade Taiwan, but I would think that the Chinese Navy will proceed with a kind of economic blockade, which will make the life in Taiwan unbearable. And since I don't think that the U.S. will be able to fight three wars at a time, remember that the U.S. is still helping Ukraine in its war against Russia. It's fighting a war in the Middle East. I'm not really sure that the U.S. Army has the ability to fight three wars at a time. So, I mean, the people in Washington will have to make choices. And I think that because, and we all know it's not a secret, that the people of Washington are elected and sponsored by the Israel lobby, they will probably choose to continue to fight in the Middle East and let go Taiwan at some point. I don't know how long this economic blockade will have to last to make the life in Taiwan painful. I think that the economic blockade of Taiwan would most likely impact the US AI companies. And I want to remember everyone here is that in the old assets which were targeted in the Middle East, in fact, some data centers of Amazon, Oracle, and other AI American companies were also targeted in the UAE, meaning that this war is not only about commodities, it's not only about oil, it's also about who controls the AI race. And we all know that first, to boost the AI race, you need cheap energy, abundant energy, and you need big data center. And I think that in fact, all these data center, which were built by this American tech giant in the Middle East, are under threat.
So a lot of stuff going on. We're looking at energy, we're looking at shipping routes, commodities. Where do you see stress building that the markets haven't really priced in yet? What are you keeping an eye on?
Well, I think that all this rise in commodities and especially in food commodities at the end of the day will translate into social unrest, social chaos. We have already seen signs of social chaos in Europe, because in Europe, the pain threshold is very low. So this is probably where the first social unrest materialized. But at the end of the day, you will have social unrest almost everywhere, at least in many countries. And I think that it will probably also materialize into social unrest in the US itself. And I mean, we are only a few months away from the midterm election. And I think that if the war is not successfully concluded for this administration, I would say before the summer, and I think that it's most impossible for them to declare a real victory. We all know that the US won the war the first hours of the first day, but I mean, after 6 weeks, there's still a war ongoing. I mean that if there's not a real victory for this administration, I think that this will mean much higher pain for the US consumer. And so most likely this will impact the result of the midterm election. On that matter, I would think that, and some may think I'm a complotist, but again, I would think that this administration would look to rally everyone around the Trump flag. And I think that the danger for the US citizen is that a kind of 9/11 event happened on the US territory, because this kind of 9/11 event, would it be a false flag or not, nobody will ever know, would probably be a way for this administration to change the way that the majority of Americans see this epic furry operation. So I would think that if I would live in the US, I would be very careful. I wouldn't attend events with a lot of crowds, and especially I would avoid to attend events with a lot of crowds in blue states, especially in California, because I think that's probably where such a kind of false flag event could take place. I think for the markets, what the market still has not understood is that this war will last longer than many analysts forecast. And this means that the price of commodities, almost all commodities, from oil to gas, to gasoline, to base metal, to precious metal, to agriculture commodities, will move much higher. So if there is a dip for investors to buy is the dip in these commodities and in the producers of these commodities, especially those producers who have their mines or their operation in North America.
Lauren, it's always great to get your insights. Before I wind down here, I wanted to ask you, you said that be careful and if you're in cities, large gatherings in blue states. I'm going, why blue states? Is it be just because of the population? Is it political? Why blue states?
Well, I think that if the false flag event happened, it would probably be in a blue state because that would be a way for this administration to rally even more people around the Republican flag ahead of the midterm election. So, I mean, 9/11 happened in New York. If I would have to put a bet on the next kind of this kind of event, I would put it in Los Angeles or San Francisco. So I would avoid even to live in these cities.
Lauren, thanks for sharing your insights. Where can people find you, your work, your socials, and if you can tell us a little bit about your Substack?
Well, I'm on Substack, the Macro Butler. I publish a weekly newsletter. I also have a website, themarcobutler.com. So, in fact, in January, I launched a financial online academy. And the goal is to promote financial freedom because, in this kind of environment, I think that everyone deserves to be financially educated. And those who will be financially free will be free from this tyrannic government. I'm also on Telegram. And I'm also on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Awesome. That's Laurent Lequeux, the Macro Butler, everybody. Thanks so much, Lauren, for being here. I'm just Steve Yang, everybody, learning alongside you from people smarter than me. Stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Lauren, thanks again.
Thank you, Steve, and always a pleasure.
Likewise.